and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin.
And we've got a great show for you this week. We're still at home, still recording in the home studio. Obviously, still don't want to infect any other radio hosts or support staff at the radio station. And again, we're all doing our part. But we have a great show. Like I said, we are going to be obviously catching up on the news and all of that. And I have a very special guest for my deep dive, and that is Paul Walsh. And Paul, I apologize. As I was listening to our recorded interview, I realized I called you Paul Walsh, and I am so sorry for that, but it is a great interview. This guy is brilliant, and he was at the foundation of what we know as the World Wide Web and the Internet, coming right off the heels of Tim Berners-Lee. So it's going to be a great interview. Stick around, and as always, let's start with the news. And this news is actually, I find, rather interesting. It's coming from a couple of different sources, including the Houston Chronicle and the Associated Press. And I think this is actually indicative of what we have as a nationwide issue here in the United States. Now, if you are basically listening to this, you have internet, odds are, in your home, or maybe just obviously the radio as we are sitting here on radio. But many people rely on school or work or libraries for actual internet connections. But what happens when your kids need the internet to continue their education while we're all at home? What happens if you need it for your work? And that's what we're talking about. And this first bit of news comes from the Houston Chronicle here, because a massive number of Houston area students, likely exceeding 100,000, lack broadband internet at home during the coronavirus shutdown, meaning they have a very serious problem when they are trying to access those materials they need to basically perform at school. We are all moving to e-learning, or rather our kids are, and college, if you're listening to this in college. And so here we are. That's actually a very serious issue, as well as a disparity. Now, I find Houston to be very interesting, because depending on the year or so, Houston is either the third or fourth largest city in the United States, either behind or in front of Chicago, where, you know, I'm based out of. And we are also seeing that other major urban areas, like the bigger ones than those two, like Los Angeles and New York, also have this problem as well. But we have a lot of low-income, basically, pockets throughout the United States that have a very serious issue with actually trying to get broadband. And that is a very serious problem when we can't go to work or school or a library. Now, the districts in Houston have received thousands of hotspots. That's that little device that you'd get from a mobile carrier that basically gives you wireless internet. But the need for connectivity is outpacing the availability for these devices. Now, two officials that have been deeply involved in attempting to buy hotspots for the Houston School District, which is their chief technology officer, as well as the president for the 1 Million Project Foundation, which is a nonprofit that provides free hotspots and internet service to school districts, said that lower grade devices can be obtained in about a month, while higher quality hotspots take about 3 to 4 months to receive. This means that we have a whole swath of students, roughly 100,000 or so in Houston, that are either falling behind their peers or simply can't get access to technology that they need to actually continue. And this actually dovetails with the Associated Press article that just came out alongside the Houston Chronicle article. And that article is entitled, "Those Without Broadband Struggle in a Stuck-at-Home Nation." And the example they give is the town of Sandwich, New Hampshire. Now, this is a town of 1,200 and is apparently best known to be the setting for the movie On Golden Pond. And broadband is rather scarce there. You can't stream Netflix. It's very hard to work or study from home. Even their police department has trouble uploading its reports. And now that we're in the middle of the coronavirus and everybody is sheltering in place, that is a very serious problem for the residents of Sandwich, New Hampshire. Now, this is happening for millions, literally in the United States right now. We are taking for granted that not every place in this country has kept pace with the always expanding internet. And while I'm sure there are other organizations, excuse me, not organizations, there are other countries out there that have this exact same problem, the articles that I am addressing here and my research focus purely on the United States. And since my radio show is based in the US, here we are. And so with that, the Associated Press also released a graph of school districts around the area where the percentage of students have no internet. And many don't even have a computer at home. They have been traditionally relying on the school or the library to actually get them internet. And this is something that most of us don't really consider. And a good chunk of you are probably listening to this after the radio broadcast when it gets converted basically into an audio file uploaded into SoundCloud and all of that. And the people that basically I'm about to talk about here in these various school districts will never hear this show. You know, and that is, I think, a very serious problem. Not that they can't hear this show, but because they don't have the internet to be able to access anything at all in the planet, including this show. So with that, if we're looking at it, the number one district in the United States that has a percentage of no internet clocks in at almost 67%. Just more than two-thirds of that entire school district has no internet at home, and that is the North Harlem Colony Elementary School District in the state of Montana. At 60% is the Stehekin, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Stehekin School District in the state of Washington, Death Valley Unified School Districts in California, followed by one in Texas, and then Minnesota, Montana, Arizona, Arkansas, and Minnesota. At number 10, that would be Lake of the Woods School District in Minnesota, has only basically 39.7%, basically 40%, 4 in 10 do not have the internet at home. And in terms of computers as well, if we're looking at this, what clocks in at number 6, Trail Creek Elementary School District in Montana, more than a quarter, 26.1%, don't even have a computer at home. This is a huge issue. And I think what the coronavirus or COVID-19 is doing is really showing that there is a massive disparity, a massive gap in the educational system here. But there's also a massive gap in the internet infrastructure. I know that, you know, I live in the Chicagoland area and I can drive a short distance, you know, and basically get into cornfields. And I know that that community, those farming communities, don't have anywhere near what I can get in the greater Chicagoland area with the amount of infrastructure we have. And I think that's a serious problem, and it's something that needs to be addressed. And so with that, that is your news of the day. And I think it's something we all need to address here in America, because if anything, I think it underscores this gap that shouldn't be. The internet is foundational to communication, to education, to business, to everything else. And how is a student going to get ahead if they can't get access to the internet at will? I think that's something we need to discuss as a society, and that's why it's a news article here, or rather a news bit here on this radio show. And so with that, let's move on. And in both Apple and Google news, and I honestly think, I was just thinking about this is probably the first time in the almost 3 years I've been doing this radio show that I've had a news item that includes both Apple and Google doing the exact same thing. But I'm telling you, the coronavirus breeds some unusual times. Now, this past Friday or so, about a week ago from when you're probably hearing this, Apple and Google announced a system for tracking the spread of the new coronavirus, allowing users to share data through what the technology known as Bluetooth low energy transmissions. And basically, this is going to be sharing it with approved apps from health organizations. Now, here's what's going on. This new system would use short-range Bluetooth communication to establish voluntary contact tracing, basically creating a network of this, keeping extensive data on your phone that has been in close proximity with other phones. Now, official apps from public health authorities like the CDC or the World Health Organization would then get access to this data, and users who download these apps can then also report if they've been diagnosed with COVID-19. The system will also alert people who download the app to whether they're in close proximity or contact with an infected person. Apple and Google are planning on introducing a pair of both iOS, that is the operating system that Apple uses, and Android, obviously everybody knows Android phone, API, or application programming interface, in mid-May, and also make sure that the health authority apps can basically integrate and grab this information. Now, this is, I think, absolutely interesting, because what this means is that if you have an iPhone or an Android, you know, Samsung, LG, Google, you know, take your pick, they all run Android except for Apple, this app, along with Apple's app, because they're doing this apparently jointly, means that if your Bluetooth is on and you install this app, and let's say you've had coronavirus, you punch in, I've had coronavirus, and you give it all this information, this is actually going to basically feed into the World Health Organization and the CDC. But because this app is running on your Bluetooth, as your phone gets into proximity with, let's say, other phones that have Bluetooth on, and let's say you're the one with coronavirus, as people with this app basically get into your proximity, what's going to happen is their phone's going to be alerted to say, hey, you're within X amount of feet of somebody who has declared themselves to have been previously infected by the coronavirus or infected by the coronavirus. That's actually rather interesting, and that's kind of big news, because we are looking at an unprecedented level of sharing and cooperation. Now, the problem that we have with this is that Google, and Apple to a much, much lesser extent than Google, but Apple is not off the hook here, Google data mines the bejesus out of everything, because literally that is their business model. They data mine to sell to advertisers. And I'm wondering how this new coronavirus tracking is going to basically mold into Google Health, and obviously Apple, you know, how they're data mining. I'm curious to know where that's going to go, because I'm just wondering if while they are giving us this kind of information, they are also going to be, you know, tracking this for themselves to sell to things like insurance companies. This is the perpetual problem that we have. And oftentimes when we have emergency situations where an entire nation, or in this case, the globe, comes together, oftentimes power or flexibility is extended to companies that had previously been on the radar by government for data mining. If you recall in the last, you know, few couple of years, 2 years, 3 years or so, and I've mentioned it extensively on this radio show, that both Google and Apple, primarily Google, as well as Facebook and some others, have been under fire from the U.S. government for privacy violation. And now everybody's looking at these massive tech platforms saying, help us, Google, you're our only hope. And so I'm very curious to see how this shakes down, but you can integrate in this, and this will help the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the Centers for Disease Control, as well as other official outlets, probably Johns Hopkins and some others. But we have to obviously balance this, and I'm very curious to see where this is going to go, because that's a huge, huge thing. So with that, that I found very interesting, but that is, I think, for the first time ever on this radio show, a joint Apple and Google collaboration news story.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in Facebook news, Facebook is actually now prompting many, if not all, U.S. users to fill out a COVID-19 survey to basically help them track the virus, which obviously I hope they're planning on turning over to major organizations. But starting as of like about a week, week and a half ago or so from when you're listening to this, Facebook users will see a new pop-up on their app asking them to complete a survey about COVID-19 or coronavirus. Now, this survey from Carnegie Mellon University's Delphi Epidemiological Research Center is one of many new symptom mapping projects that seek to anticipate where the next wave of the coronavirus will hit obviously as it is basically blowing through the world right now. Now, as often the case in research, the challenge for many of these symptom mapping efforts is actually attracting a large enough sample of respondents to paint a statistically meaningful or accurate picture. Carnegie Mellon's research effort will get a huge boost from Facebook, because basically Facebook is the world's largest platform. Now, Facebook's promotion of Carnegie Mellon's survey means that it can instantly reach a massive amount of users, like as I mentioned, from the largest pool of online users. And Facebook, interestingly enough, has declined to provide details on how many users will be seeing this prompt. But even if it's a subsection of United States users, let's say over the age of 18, it's going to be massive, because Facebook is almost 4 billion users worldwide. Much of the internet is using Facebook. Now, according to Facebook's announcement, this survey data collected will aid public health planning around resource allocation and basically start looking at maybe those sections of society where the coronavirus seems to have receded. So obviously the United States is a rather large country. If there are pockets of the United States where the coronavirus, let's say by virtue of survey and other forms of identification, is not that prevalent, or let's say it's vastly receded, maybe that's an area of the United States that can basically restart its engine, that is the economy, and that's what we're talking about here. The flip side to this is obviously Facebook is known to data mine the bejesus out of everything with a complete and utter lack of, any lack of regard for data mining whatsoever. They're horrible at this. And so I'm wondering if Facebook is going to be taking this information and selling it to basically anybody with cash, because that is what Facebook does. So while you can take this survey and it's going to help Carnegie Mellon, which obviously is a known excellent university, and I wish them all the best in the world in tracking this as we come together as a society, I just hope that Facebook on their back end isn't going to abuse what Carnegie Mellon is trying to collect in earnest. So take that for what it's worth, but if you're on Facebook, odds are you're starting to see surveys for COVID-19, and that is thanks to Carnegie Mellon University.
And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you, or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
And this week's Breaches of the Week is absolutely fascinating. I think as we've been going on, and typically because I do this radio show every 2 weeks, I usually give you 2 weeks of data breaches, but there have been so many data breaches, and it's directly as a result of the coronavirus outbreak, because quite frankly, with the entire world's attention focused on coronavirus news, now is the perfect time to declare a data breach, because nobody is listening, watching, or reading this except for my listeners. So boom, you are probably one of the, I don't know, five people on the planet, and I hope I have more than five listeners that actually know about these data breaches, because quite frankly, these things keep going on and they just keep getting nuts. Now, before I dive in, I'd like to thank the following people that sent me tips, information, all of this kind of stuff. And that would be Jason Dance, Neville Goodles, Chris Fallon, and David Walker. Guys, thank you very much for sending me tips. It always helps me out. And with that, let's get going. And we're going to be starting with a company, actually two companies, called Advantage Capital Funding and Argus Capital Funding. They jointly developed an app. And here we go. Now, this app, which is no longer available for download, stored data on an Amazon Web Services S3 bucket in a database that apparently didn't have any form of encryption or authentication or passwords or anything else. Now, the consequence was that over 500,000 thousand documents were left vulnerable on this unprotected server, and this included really sensitive information like credit reports, bank statements, contracts, legal documents, driver's license copies, purchase orders and receipts, tax returns, social security numbers, as well as transaction reports, and 425 gigabytes were exposed. So if you have anything to do with Advantage Capital Funding or Argus Capital Funding, heads up, you got exposed. Moving on, we're going to be talking about a payments processor used by local governments called NCORT. Now, they're used to collect things like court fines and utility bills, and they are heavily focused on residents across Arkansas and Oklahoma, and they mistakenly left an exposed website open that had a whole bunch of data representing years of transactions. Now, a security researcher named Ashat Ogunsian, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, found a cache of database files in a public and unprotected web directory on the website of NCORT, which basically runs two different sites, courtpay.org and utilitypay.org. Now, this directory contained a backup database of files storing at least 3 years worth of transactions, which basically went from way back 3 years up to November of 2019. Now, 79,000 transaction records were on courtpay.org and 64,000 records were on utilitypay.org. This information included the payee's name, postal address, email address, and phone number. Each record also contained the payment card type, as well as the last four digits of the credit card number and the expiration date. So just enough probably to run a identity theft scam. But if you use NCORT in Arkansas and Oklahoma on any of the stations I'm on there, out there, heads up to you. Moving on, we're going to head on over to Italy and talk about Monte di Paschi. And I again, apologize for my pronunciation to anybody that's listening from Italy or knows Italian, but this is one of the biggest banks in Italy. Attackers accessed mailboxes of some of the employees and then started sending email to the bank's clients. Now, according to their notice, the attack took place on March 30th when some messages with voicemail attachments were sent. Obviously, these voicemail attachments were infected. Now, at the time, it's not clear if the attackers stole any of the company's data, and the bank thus far has not provided technical details of the cyber attack. But under the European Union's GDPR, I'm guessing within 90 days or so, we will have a much better understanding of what happened to Monte di Paschi. So if you use them as a bank, heads up to you. Moving on, let's roll on back to the United States and talk about Hammersmith Medicines Research. Now, this is interesting because they are a research company on standby to start performing live trials of a coronavirus vaccine, or rather a potential vaccine. And they started emailing data breach notifications after having their data stolen and then published in a ransomware attack. Now, this is what happened. The attack occurred on March 14th of this year when the Maze ransomware operators stole this data hosted on their network and then began to encrypt the computers. After the ransom was not paid, the Maze ransomware group, or the operators, published some of the stolen data on their news site on March 21st to basically try to extort Hammersmith Medicines from making this payment. Now, at that time, HMR, the company, stated that they could not afford the ransom and they wouldn't pay it even if they could. And to quote the managing clinical director of HMR, Malcolm Boyce, and I quote, "We have no intention of paying. I would rather go out of business than pay a ransom to these people." And Malcolm, you have a fan in me, my friend. I am happy to see that. Nevertheless, I find it kind of amazing because the Maze ransomware group was one of those dark web groups that said that they are not going to go after anything coronavirus related because apparently they have honor among thieves. And I think they just proved there is no honor among thieves, and here we are. So I hope Hammersmith gets out of this. Moving on, we're heading actually back to Italy for an email provider known as email.it or email it. I think that's actually pretty clever. Now, the data, unfortunately, of more than 600 600,000 email IT users is currently being sold on the dark web. Now, in a statement to ZDNet about a week and a half ago, the Italian email provider said, and I quote, "Unfortunately, we must confirm that we have suffered a hacker attack." Now, the email IT hack came to light about a week ago or so when hackers went on Twitter to promote a website on the dark web where they were actually selling the company's data. Now, the attackers, going by the name of NN or No Name Hacking Group, claim the actual intrusion took place actually more than 2 years ago in January of 2018. So we'll see where this goes. But if you use email-IT, which is Italian-based but used around the world, heads up to you. Moving on, we are talking about a company called MorrowPost. This is an email delivery and marketing firm, and a database owned by them was reportedly found open and unsecured, exposing about 95 million customer records. Now, researchers at Cyber News initially found the database in early February, noting that it contained 19.2 million unique email addresses and marketing logs containing the relevant metadata for these emails, such as things like exact date and time the emails were sent, who sent them and to whom, etc. Now, the data resided on a Google Cloud server, and it was eventually locked down on April 1st. Cyber News claimed that it tried multiple times using email, social media, and the telephone to inform MorrowPost of this issue, and didn't really hear back. Cyber News said that no personally identifiable information was included in the database, but pointed out that the email addresses and metadata could be used for phishing scams. So here we are. If you use MorrowPost, or maybe you were targeted by them, you could be in a database. Moving on, we're going to be talking about an organization, or rather a company slash app called Keyring. Now, this app lets users store digital copies of their loyalty cards and basically do other things like create shopping lists, receive weekly deals, etc. So if you have like a loyalty card to, you know, I don't know, like a Best Buy or a Walmart or whatever your retail is in your country, you could basically take a picture of your loyalty card and stick it on up in Keyring, and so you wouldn't have to carry these cards around your wallet. And they didn't have one. They had five misconfigured Amazon Web Services S3 buckets, meaning databases, revealing the private data of Keyring users. And this was discovered in January by the research firm VPN Mentor. Holy cow, this is huge.
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.